nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so the last few days we have spent kind of discussing this set of equations, which you can use to calculate the current voltage characteristics of any nanoscale device, essentially, where the input is this density of states and these escape rates, the way how well the contacts connect to the channel. Now, today I'd like to move on to the next topic, but before that, I just wanted to say a few words about this set of equations, just as kind of summary, and yeah, that basically there are two types of things you usually calculate with any device. One is current versus drain voltage, the other is current versus gate voltage, and the role of these things is very different. And last day we were talking about how things vary with the gate voltage for a given fixed drain voltage, some small drain voltage, how the conductance changes, how the number of electrons changes, and so on. And an important point there is that you have to solve these two equations self-consistently. That's a very important point. That the number of electrons depends on U, U being the potential energy inside the channel. And the question you could ask is that if I put, say, 1 volt on the gate, how much does the potential energy inside the channel change? And often the first term in that is this U sub L, which, you know, ideally what you'd like is if I put 1 volt here, the potential here should also change by 1 volt. What that means is the potential energy should change by 1 electron volt. And it usually goes the opposite, in the sense that a positive voltage actually lowers the U. And so what it does is a positive voltage actually will pull this down. Right? Because if you put positive, U will be negative, and that will pull this down, basically. Okay. And ideally, you'd like 1 volt there to appear as 1 electron volt here. In practice, it won't be quite that good, necessarily, because you've got a source and a drain and a gate voltage. So let's say this we take as our reference. So this is like zero. So you have put 1 volt here and you're putting some voltage on the drain. And what you get here would be some weighted average of the two. And for a good transistor, you'd like it to be determined largely by the gate rather than by the drain. That's understood. Okay. So that's what determines the U sub L. And if you're really doing this quantitatively, what you'd be doing is you'd be solving what's called this Laplace equation, that's del square U equals zero, subject to the boundary conditions that this quantity is zero here, one there, and whatever it is on that electrode. That's what you'd actually have to do, which we won't really be going into. But that's what this one is about. But what makes this a little more complicated is the second term. You see, if you didn't have this term, then you even wouldn't have to worry about doing this self-consistently. Because then you have a U, that's U sub L, put it in there, get N, get I. It's a straight calculation. This is what requires you to do things self-consistently. And one way to visualize what you're doing is that we could take that first equation and plot N versus U. So this is the potential energy inside the channel, and we'll look at N. Well, in fact, let's call this N minus N0. That way we know that this curve will go through the origin. Why? Because by definition, N0 is like what the number of electrons is when U is 0, when the density of states is in its reference position, no U. So whatever you have at that stage, that's what you call N0 anyway. So we could plot N minus N0. That way at U equals 0, by definition it's 0. Question is, what will it look like? What will this plot look like? And if the density of states looks like what I've drawn here, what you'd expect is that you see, if I put a positive U, then what it will do is raise this up, a positive U. That's what dE minus U does. Of course, a positive U really means a negative gate voltage. That's one of the confusing things that you have to keep track of. Okay, but if U is positive, it raises it up, and so the number of electrons would go down. Would basically, you know, the way I've drawn it, at zero temperature, you have hardly any electrons because the chemical potential is below the density of states. And then if you lift it even higher, it will just get even less. So basically on this side, you'd expect the curve to look something like this. On the other hand, if you make U negative, that means you're actually pulling it down, then you'd expect something like this. And at zero temperature, you'd have kind of a sharp thing like this. If you actually do this calculation at some non-zero temperature, then you'd find this thing rounded off somewhat. So the actual thing would be kind of, I guess, it wouldn't quite be, you see, sharp like so, but would actually kind of go like this, be rounded off. Actually, I guess it has to still go through the origin. What I should draw is, this side is not exactly zero, but will be some value here, and the when you put in the temperature, it will kind of get rounded off. Now, this is the part where it is, kind of part where it actually goes exponentially, what we discussed last day as the exponential minus U over KT. But the part I wanted to talk a little more about right now, before we finish up, is this part. That is, when you are actually pulling this down and increasing the number of electrons in there. So this part, the slope of this, depends on the density of states. If you have lots of states, of course, the slope will be higher. That you can see. Now, so this quantity, dN dU, how much does the number of electrons change as a result of changing U? That is kind of like what people call the quantum capacitance, actually with a negative there. Negative because dN dU, you can see, in this case, would actually be positive. It would actually be negative in the sense as I increase U, it goes down, as you can imagine. So in general, I'd say CQ would be like the magnitude of this. That's what you would normally write it as. Now, actually, it's not exactly this. It is this thing divided by Q squared. Now, why is that? Well, because capacitance is like change in the amount of charge due to the change in the amount in the voltage. Now, charge and number of electrons are kind of related by a Q, just as potential energy is related to voltage by a Q. And because of those two Qs, you kind of need the Q squared there. Because, you see, what I could do is take the Q squared off of here and put one here and one of them here. You see, that would be like that Q squared. I'm kind of put, and then you see the Q times the N is like charge, and U divided by Q would be like the voltage, you see? So when you write dN dQ, it actually has the dimensions of capacitance divided by Q squared overall. Anyway, now, if this term were not there, then of course U would be equal to U sub L, and so you'd say dN dU is equal to dN dUL. In that case, this is not generally true. But if this second term were not there, then this is all that there would be. So once you know UL, you can say that, okay, if I change U sub L from here to there, the corresponding electron density should go from here to here. And how much does it change? Well, it depends on that slope. That's what we call quantum capacitance. That's pretty clear. Okay, now, because of this, what happens is you need this self-consistent solution. So the way to think about it is N versus U, because of that equation, say, looks something like this. Now, there's another relationship between U and N, which is this equation. And those two have to be solved simultaneously, which means you kind of draw the two graphs and see where they intersect. So if I were to plot this one, it would look something like why? Because, you know, what would this point be? Can you help me? So what I'm trying to draw is a graph of U sub L plus U0 times N minus N0. So can you help me with what that point is? This is a point, right? Because this is a point where N minus N0 is equal to 0. So U is equal to U sub L itself. So that point is really U sub L. You see? And then the slope of this, that's what depends on U0. So what I, so if U0 were 0, this curve would have just gone straight up like that. It would all, U would always be equal to U sub L. On the other hand, if you have a huge charging energy, that means if every electron makes a big difference to this potential, then the curve would be more like that. And by solving these two self-consistently, essentially what you're doing is trying to find that intersection point. That kind of tells you where things are. And now what happens is when I change U sub L, you know, how much the solution actually changes is not quite determined by this quantum capacitance anymore. Not, at least not just by the quantum capacitance. This also depends on the slope of this curve. You see, because now if I change U sub L, I'll be making a change of just that much, not this much. You see, that change would be less. Now, mathematically, what you could do is, you could ask that how much does U change when I change U sub L by a little bit, let's say. So you could say that, what is du, du sub L? And that would be equal to, for the first term, when I take a derivative with respect to U sub L, I just get 1. This is a constant. And then I get dN dUL. And the second quantity here, I could write as dN dU times dU dUL. So you see, I've got dU dUL here, and I also have it here, so I could kind of pull it over to this side. So I could write so all I did here is pulled this over to this side. So I had this times 1 minus u0 dn du, and then I divided it there. Which is equal to 1 divided by 1 plus u0 times cq over u square. Because remember, this dn du is what we call the quantum capacitance. Except for that Q square thing, that's all. Okay? Now, you could put this in a slightly clearer form by saying this, that what's this U0? Well, U0 is like, if I change the number of electrons inside by 1, how much does the potential change? You see? And if you think of this kind of like a capacitor, then you could argue that on a capacitor C, when you put an amount of charge Q, its potential changes by Q over C, which means the potential energy changes by Q squared over C. So you could view this U0 as like Q squared over some effective capacitance. And that capacitance is more like the usual freshman physics capacitance that comes from just putting a charge here, that whenever I put a negative charge here, positive charges appear on the various plates. So as a result, the potential changes. So whatever that is. And we'll talk a little more about the nature of this U0 and what it is in small devices. That's something we'll be talking about in the next few days, actually, a lot more. We'll get into this. This is what's often called the single electron charging energy. That one electron, when you put on a device, how much does the potential change? We'll talk more about it. But you could kind of write it this way, in which case you'll notice this then becomes 1 plus 1 plus CQ over C. That's it. So the point I'm trying to get at is that if you had a material where CQ is very small, what that means is, remember, basically what CQ is it's like the density of states. It's proportional to the density of states. If you have lots of states, you have a high quantum capacitance. If you have very few states, that's small. So this is like density of states. So if you had a material with a very low density of states, then you see this ratio is essentially 1. What that means is, however you change U sub L, you will change much the same way. So U and U sub L are essentially the same then. On the other hand, if you have a material with lots of states in it, which is often the case usually, in big conductors especially, the CQ is large. And if it's large, then you can drop this. And then, even when you change U sub L by a lot, the U doesn't change a whole lot, really. The actual potential inside. So you put 1 volt here, and you think that this should change by 1 volt, or something close, because U sub L is 1 volt. But the thing is, actually, it will change a whole lot less. See? And the net result is that when you look at the, okay, so this is du du sub L. So if you want to know how much does the number of electrons change due to a change in the Laplace potential, UL, you could write this as dN dU times dU dL. And the point is, the dN dU, that part is just like the quantum capacitance. But this part is more like C divided by C plus Q. So, I mean, I'm not worrying about the Q square and minus signs. I'm just trying to get the rough idea that if you change U sub L by a little bit and you want to know how much N changes, in materials where CQ is small, you can drop this here, the Cs will cancel, and the change will be determined by this. On the other hand, in materials where CQ is large, you can drop this, and then these two cancel, and basically it is just the usual capacitance that determines everything. So because this combination, it's like putting two capacitors in series, a C and a CQ. Because this is like the series of two capacitors, series combination of two capacitors. And so whichever is smaller determines what is effectively what you get. Whichever is smaller, not the bigger one, that's the thing. And that's why, as I said, when you are talking about a transistor that's in its off state means density of states is very low, which means the quantum capacitance is very small. So then everything is determined by the quantum capacitance when it's in its off state. And that's kind of what we discussed last day, that in the off state, how you have that 60 millivolt per decade and all that stuff. On the other hand, when it's in its on state, CQ usually is big. Except that these days people are talking about small conductors where even in its on state, the CQ is not all that big. And so you actually have to worry about the series combination of things rather than just the ordinary capacitance. Okay? And physically you can see this. These are two very different things in the sense that ordinary capacitance comes from the electron-electron interaction. It's the fact that when you put many charges on a capacitor, there is an amount of energy which represents the interaction energy of the electrons. It's because electrons are interacting objects. That's this. Whereas CQ is just related to density of states, which comes from the Schrodinger equation. the way you actually calculate this density of states is from the Schrodinger equation, taking into account the wave nature of things. So in that sense, two are very different physics. One was known in the 19th century. The other is more like 20th century. Two very different things, you see. Okay. Okay, so main thing then I wanted to stress here is this need to do things self-consistently, usually, because lots of times we focus a lot on this and don't actually solve things self-consistently, but just take things, approximately assume that it would work that if you did it self-consistently, it would come out in a certain way. For example, supposing you have a density of states like this, and you have some mu here. Now, or let me raise it a little bit. So the equilibrium mu is somewhere here. And you put a voltage across it. Now, one question that often comes up is that if I put a voltage across this, I know that overall the two chemical potentials will shift by QV. But the question is, which will shift how much? So for example, I could have assumed that this is fixed and this one goes down, let's say. Or I could have assumed that this is fixed and this one goes up. You see, question is, which is correct? And of course, depending on which one you assume, you'll get totally different IVs as it stands. But the point I wanted to stress is that regardless of which way you do it, you'd get the same answer if you did the calculation self-consistently. Because what would happen is this. If, let's say, we hold it here and we pull this down, then you'd be emptying out these states somewhat. And because these states got emptied, when you do this thing self-consistently, it will come down somewhat. So as long as you take into account this U sub L and everything else carefully, you'd find that this also comes down and everything, and you get a particular answer. On the other hand, if you raise this, then you also have to remember to raise this accordingly. So the point I was trying to make is that in the first homework, for example, I told you to assume that the middle conductor as your reference, so you don't worry about moving this. Assume that it's fixed, that's zero, and then put half on one side and the other half on the other side. So assume this goes up by half the voltage, this goes up by other half. Now, you could always subtract a constant from the whole thing. It would make no difference. So you could turn this into a zero and call this minus 0.5 and call this minus 1. Those are equivalent things. But what would be wrong, of course, is if you put a 0 here and a minus 1 here and forget to shift this one, so you keep it that way. Because then you see this and this are not equivalent things at all. As long as you move everything consistently, a constant added to the whole thing makes no difference. That's the thing to remember as you do these things. Okay? Right. So U sub L is important to take into account, and more correctly, you should also do it self-consistently. Okay. Okay, so this set of equations then sort of allows you to calculate the current voltage characteristics from any small device, as long as you know the density of states. And we discussed the gamma for long devices usually depends on the velocity. So if you know the density of states and the velocity. And that's kind of what we'll be talking about much of October, as I've mentioned. And this month, the two things I want to talk a little more about is, firstly, a little bit about the Schrodinger equation and how people calculate states, a little bit about that, and also a little bit about this U0, where it comes from, this electron-electron interaction. Because in a way, the biggest problem that people don't quite know how to handle exactly is this electron-electron interaction. I mean, this is why almost anything you calculate is approximate. Because that's the one thing no one knows exactly how to do. And everything that is done is always approximate, which is why it terribly important to always compare with experiment, because anything you're doing is approximate, and the only way you know that what you're doing has any connection with reality is because it's matching experiment reasonably well. See? Okay. So this interaction aspect, I wanted to stress a little bit before we go on further. So that's kind of what we'll be doing. Now, as I said, the Schrödinger equation is the starting point for all calculations of this density of states, of where these states come from, etc. And all this kind of started about 100 years ago, say, when people were trying to understand the spectrum, the light that was emitted from like the simplest of materials, which is the hydrogen atom. So they had a gas of hydrogen atoms, you see. And the light that was emitted showed certain specific frequencies. And what that gave people the idea that the electrons inside the atom must have discrete energy levels. So that the picture was that when you heat it up, when you heat up the gas, then what happens is the electrons go to one of the higher states, and then when they jump down, that's when they emit the light. That's this H nu, which is the difference between these energy levels. And what people found was that you could write this H nu as E0 times 1 over some integer times some other integer. So all the light that was emitted when you looked at their frequencies, which could be measured very accurately, it would fit something like this, giving people the idea that the energy levels inside a hydrogen atom, you should be able to write as E0 over n square, where n is some integer, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And the challenge was then to understand where this came from, you see, and after a lot of effort, actually, like over 10, 15 years, in 1925, Schrödinger wrote down this Schrödinger equation, and that was an equation that could be solved exactly. So the equation, let me just write it for the moment. We'll talk more about it in a minute. So this is the Schrödinger equation, where there is the psi, that's the wave function for the electrons, and this equation, the u that goes in here, is the potential that an electron sees due to the nucleus. Because the picture people had of a hydrogen atom, which they again knew from experiments, is that there is a positive charge, the positive nucleus, which is like almost like a point source. It's like a point thing that occupies a very small volume of the whole thing. And around it, there's this electron. There's this electron E. And what goes into this Schrödinger equation is potential energy. It is the potential energy that an electron sees due to a point charge. So how much is, what is that? What is the, so this point charge, this is, let's say, ZQ, Z being the atomic number. For hydrogen atom, it would just be Q. A proton has exactly the same charge as the electron, it's just plus Q. And this potential energy looks like so if you have a point charge at some point, then the potential due to that goes down as 1 over r from that point. That's this Coulomb's law. And the force is 1 over r square. The electric field is 1 over r square. The potential is 1 over r. And the potential itself would be that. I guess zq if you include that. So this would be the potential. And the potential energy of the electron is zq square. And there's a minus here. So what's the minus refer to? The minus being the idea that if this electron, instead of being here, were somewhere out here, would the energy be bigger or smaller?
Bigger.
It would be bigger, which means whatever it is when it is here, you need to provide it with energy. You have to actually make an effort to get it out. Why is that? Because this actually is being pulled in here. So if you left it there, it would want to kind of gravitate in, want to come in. So the negative refers to the fact that, yeah, left to itself, it would want to come in, and thereby this would be like a lower energy state. And to get it out is when you have to put some energy into it. So anyway, so that's why this is minus. And this is the equation that Schrodinger was able to solve exactly, analytically, actually. And when he did that, he found the energy levels that actually matched exactly what is being observed experimentally. And that, of course, at that time gave people the confidence or gave the feeling that there must be something right about this. But the thing is, at that point, no one exactly knew what psi was. I mean, for the next 20 years, people argued about what psi means. You see? It's not yet clear what exactly that is. But the thing is, there had to be something right about this equation. Because, after all, it's predicting exactly the right energies that you expect. That is known from experiment. You see? Okay. Now, let me just say one word about what's involved in trying to solve this equation. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, because one of the things I'll be doing, I guess, next day, is I'll be trying to tell you how to solve this equation numerically on a computer. Because you could easily write a MATLAB code to solve this. I mean, Schrodinger couldn't, of course. At that time, you didn't have the computers. But that's something you could do, you see. And there's two reasons why that's kind of useful, is that once you have set it up on a computer, the thing is you can easily do a lot of things with it. You can easily change a potential, change it to something else, see how the energy levels change. All that's very easy. And the other important point I wanted to stress here is that, you see, the hydrogen atom is the only one where you can actually get by without a computer. What that means is that, you see, this equation, you can, as I said, Schrodinger solved it analytically. He had exact analytical solutions. But he could do that only for the hydrogen atom. You couldn't do it even for a helium atom. You see, helium atom is one where you got two positive charges and you got two electrons. Now, why is it you can do this one but you can't do that one? Well, it's just because it's the point I mentioned earlier. You see, the biggest part of this whole thing that no one really knows how to treat is this electron-electron interaction. That's this U0, that's this part about. And as soon as you get to a system with two electrons, you have that problem right away. You see, when you try to calculate energy levels of this, of one electron here, you kind of have to worry about what it sees due to the other one. And that other one is kind of spread out all over. You don't know exactly how it is spread out, etc. So just two electrons makes it harder, you see. And that's why you can see that as you get to bigger systems, it gets harder and harder in a way. So even a silicon atom, silicon, I mean, not just silicon crystal, just silicon atom means 14 electrons, you see. And so basically what happened is, what Schrodinger wrote this down in 1925, and people got convinced that, yeah, this had the right, you know, essence of what is needed to understand all this. And gradually in the course of the 20th century, people have developed very powerful methods for applying this to all kinds of much more complicated things. But in all of them, though, what you do is usually something approximate. No one quite knows how to solve it exactly. Everything that's done is really approximate. Okay? Now, one word about what is involved in solving this, because I just want to say that first, because that's what you kind of need for that third homework problem. Right? Let me just say that, and then we'll talk a little more systematically about that equation. The first point I wanted to make is that, you see, if you did not have this potential, then solving this equation is very easy. That is, okay, let's look at the one-dimensional version of this. As you know, that del squared, that's like, that's this Laplacian operator, which is partial with respect to x plus partial with respect to y, partial potential with respect to Z. So if we go to one dimension, assuming that nothing varies in Y and Z, then you have a equation like this. And if you drop that, as I said, as long as that's not there, what I claim is that the solutions to this can be written down just, you know, very simply. And the basic principle is, and this has got nothing to do with quantum mechanics, has to do with the properties of differential equations, namely that as long as a differential equation has constant coefficients, that is, these coefficients here do not depend on space or time, they don't vary with x or t, it's just some number, then the solution to this can always be written in this form. In the form of exponentials. So, in other words, a solution of this type, let me put a constant in front. So, this is some number here, whatever, let me just write A. So, some number here times this. This will always satisfy that equation, provided a certain condition is met, which I'll describe to you in a minute. Okay? And this is one thing I always like to stress a little bit, is that when it comes to algebraic equations, usually you can solve them in a methodical way. What I mean by that is, if someone told you x plus 2 is equal to 3, you can say x equals 3 minus 2 equals 1. And there's a methodical way of solving it. With differential equations, there's really no methodical way of solving it. It's more like people have, over the years, developed a catalog of solutions. That is, it is hard to tell why, looking at this, you'd immediately think of that. Not really. It's just from experience people know it. But what you can do easily is the other way. That if I told you that this is a solution, then in a few minutes you could tell me whether I'm right or wrong. Because you can always put it back in here and see if it works. So, and in a way, that's how people have discovered solutions over the years. It's like they've tried out all kinds of things using some amount of intuition, working on it, and now there's a good catalog of things. Well, when you have a equation like this, this kind of solution works, etc. Okay. So the one thing that you should know then, remember always, is that if there's a differential equation with constant coefficients, then this works. A solution in this form. With one caveat, and that is, let's put this in here, and you can see what you get. So, if I put this in here, can you help me? So, let's say I try to put this solution back in here. What will we get? Now, the nice thing about exponentials is that taking derivatives is very easy. So if you are taking derivative with respect to time, that is like multiplying with minus whatever is multiplying the time here, whatever it is. That's the property of exponentials. And so you get exactly the same function, but multiplied by whatever it is that's multiplying time in this exponent. So what that means is that ih bar d psi dt is really ih bar minus, I'm sorry, IH bar times minus IE over H bar, because that's what's multiplying the time in this exponent, times psi. In other words, derivative with respect to time is the equivalent of multiplying with minus IE over H bar, the same thing. Okay. And that's equal to then minus H bar square over 2m. And now I'm taking the derivative with respect to x. So that's equivalent to multiplying with ik. And since I'm doing it twice, it's like ik twice times psi. And question is, does that satisfy that equation? Well, provided if I cancel out the psi, if e and k are related according to this, then I'm done. That means I've kind of proved that this solution works. So it will work provided E is related to K according to this equation. Now, you could tidy this up a little bit, because you'll notice the I times the minus I is 1, H bar cancels, so the left-hand side is really just E, And the right-hand side is I square is minus 1. That cancels a minus. And so that makes it h bar square k square over 2m. Say this again. Right. Now the A, actually it should be this whole thing. What I mean by that is it's minus IE over h bar times A exponential this, exponential that, and that whole thing I'm just writing as psi. Right? So it's the whole thing. And then the psi just cancels along with all those exponential factors. It's the same on both sides. So as long as E and K are related by this relationship, this solution will work. And this is a method that you can apply to any differential equation with constant coefficients. So that this is one of those routine things that you should be able to do that I often ask on tests is that given any differential equation, how to find that? And this is what's called the dispersion relation. So for any differential equation with constant coefficients, there's a corresponding dispersion relation. And you should be able to go kind of back and forth between the two. In the sense, given this, how to get that, and given this, how to work backwards to that. Right? Okay. So the thing is then that if this term were absent, then it would have been relatively straightforward to have solved this Schrodinger equation, really. Because even if you had, say, let's say we go to two dimensions, then what would have happened is I'd have added one more thing here. So let's say we are, you know, I kind of simplified it by doing one dimension. But supposing we do two dimensions. So you put a d2 dx2 and a d2 dy2. Okay, so again, I'd say as long as you have constant coefficients, you can write the solution in the form of these exponentials with another one here, ky. Of course, those are not the same k, so I could put a kx and a ky there. Two different things. Okay, again, does it work? We'll put it all back in here. So what will happen is, when I put this into this first one, we know what to get. We'll get E psi. Write that down. We'll just get E psi. That we have gone through once, we know. The second one will give me h bar square over 2m times something times psi. Can you help me with what the something is? So the d2 dx2 will give me ikx twice. So that's the kx square, like he's saying. And then when I go to this one, then I'm taking the derivative with respect to y. So I'll pick up the iky twice. So I'll get another term which will look like h bar square ky square over 2m psi. So once again, I can cancel off the psi's. And the dispersion relation then will be E equals h bar square kx square over 2m plus h bar square ky square over 2m. That would be the dispersion. That's it. Okay? So this is one thing that you need to remember. Now the other important thing to remember is the following, that of course when you have coefficients like, when you have coefficients that actually vary in space or time, then you cannot quite write solutions in this form. But if you have a situation like this, where the coefficient depends on space but not on time, then as far as the time part of it is concerned, you can still do this. It's just that you cannot do with respect to x, y, and z anymore. That's all. You cannot do that with the space part of it. For the time part, you can still do it. So what you could do is, you could say, so with the Schrodinger equation, you could say that, well, I got something that depends on space, so that I have to solve the hard way. But what I could do is write psi rt, you know, this r stands for xyz thing, is equal to something that only depends on r times exponential minus I e t over h bar. So this kind of a solution will work here because it is a differential equation whose coefficients do not depend on time. That's why, as far as the time part is concerned, I am still allowed to do this. Now you can try this out now. If you put this in here, the first term will look like E phi times exponential minus I e t over h bar. Kind of put this outside because this is common to all of them. See? Here, this is the only one that involved the derivative with respect to time. And the derivative with respect to time amounts to just multiplying with minus IE over h bar. And that's why this just becomes E times phi with the exponential still there. This is a derivative with respect to x, y, and z. So anything to do with time can just be pulled out and put some outside, wherever you like. Same here. You write that way. And the point is you can drop this, and so you'd then be left with this equation. So you can just drop that. So you often see the Schrodinger equation in this form or in that form. You'd see both forms actually in the literature. You call this the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. You call this the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Okay? And of course, you cannot simplify further because this one depends on space. If I had dropped this, this wasn't there, then I could have even went ahead and solved the rest of it. Okay. Now, what Schrodinger solved was actually this equation. And what he showed was that when you use this use of R corresponding to the hydrogen atom, which corresponded to basically a positive nucleus with that charge, that is, when he used a U of minus ZQ square over 4 pi epsilon 0 R, what he showed was that this equation gives you non-zero solutions. What I mean by that is an equation like this, of course, always has this trivial solution. Namely, you can always put phi equals 0. That's a solution. So that's what you call the trivial solution. The question is whether there's a non-trivial solution, you know, where there's actually a phi there. And what he showed was that this equation will give you non-trivial solutions only if E takes on a certain set of values. So if I tell you a E of, you know, what, if I gave you a particular value, say minus 10 volts or minus 5 volts, the thing is, you wouldn't be able to find a solution to this. That was the point. Whereas there are certain specific values of energy, called those eigenvalues, for which there is a solution to this equation. Okay. And those particular values, what he showed analytically, were given by E0 divided by n square, where n is an integer. And this E0, we'll talk about what it is. It is actually comes to 13.6 eV, but these are fundamental constants, and I'll explain where that comes from. So what he showed was that if you just solve this, you'd get things like this. What that means is that the energy levels in here then are like, when n is equal to 1, that's the minus 13.6 eV, and then the next, which is like minus 13.6 eV divided by 4, and then divided by 9, divided by 16, and so on. So they'll have all these levels. And when you look at the difference in energy between two of them, that corresponded exactly to what the light frequencies people had actually measured from a hydrogen atom. That was the experimental fact that was known like 20 years earlier. And for 20 years, people had been searching for an equation that would allow them to predict those lines, I mean, to predict those particular values. And this equation, once it was written down, and people found that, you know, there was this analytical solution which fitted it exactly, that's when people knew there had to be something right about this. Although, as I said, even, I mean, at that point, it wasn't at all clear what this psi stands for anyway. You see? But the point is there had to be something right about it. So let me stop here today, and next day we'll continue.